Rick Deal approached the whole thing like a research project. He read a book on the female orgasm. Two books, actually. One with pictures, and he watched a video. He ran it three times, and even took notes, because one way or another, he had sworn he would get a reaction from Lisa. Now he was down there between her legs, hard at work for the last half hour, his fingers stiff, tongue aching, knees sore, but Lisa's body remained completely relaxed, indifferent to his every attention. Nothing the books predicted had occurred. No labial tumescence, no perineal engorgement, no retraction of the clitoral hood, no change in breathing, abdominal tension, moans or groans, nothing. He was exhausting himself while Lisa stared at the ceiling, zoned out like she was at the dentist's, like a person waiting for something vaguely unpleasant to be over. And then, wait a minute, her breathing changed, only slightly at first, but then distinctly. Sighing, and her stomach was tensing, rhythmically tensing. She began to squeeze her breasts and moan softly. It was working. Rick redoubled his efforts. She responded strongly. It certainly was working. Working, she was grunting now, gasping, writhing, building strongly. Her back arched, and suddenly she heaved and screamed, "Yes! Yes, Brad, yes!" Rick rocked back on his heels as if he had been hit. Lisa threw her hand over her mouth and twisted away from him on the bed. She shuddered briefly, then sat up, pushed the hair out of her eyes, looked down at him. Her cheeks were flushed, her eyes dark with arousal. "Gee," she said, "I'm really sorry." At this awkward moment, Rick's phone rang. Lisa lunged for it on the bedside table and handed it to him quickly. "Yes, what is it?" Rick snapped. He was angry. "Mr. Deal, it's Barry Sindler here." "Oh, hi, Barry. Something wrong?" "No, no." Lisa was off the bed, getting dressed, her back turned to him. "Well, I have good news for you."
"What's that?"
"As you know, last week your wife refused to undergo genetic testing, so we got a court order. Came through yesterday."
"Yes."
"And confronted with the order, your wife fled rather than submit to testing."
"What do you mean?" Rick said.
"She's gone, left town, no one knows where."
"What about the kids?"
"She abandoned them."
"Well, who's taking care of them?"
"The housekeeper. Don't you call your kids every day?"
"Yeah, usually I do, but it's been busy at work."
"When was the last time you called them?"
"I don't know. Maybe 3 days ago."
"You better get your ass over to your house right now," Sindler said. "You wanted custody of your kids, and you got it. You'd better show the court some parental responsibility."
And he hung up. He'd sounded pissed.
Rick Deal leaned back on his knees and looked at Lisa.
"I gotta go," he said.
"Okay," she said. "I'm sorry. See ya."
Bail was set at $500,000. Brad Gordon's attorney paid it. Brad knew it was his uncle's money, but at least he was free to go. As he was leaving the courtroom, the funny-looking kid in the Dodgers jacket sidled up to him and said,
"We need to talk."
"About what?"
"You were set up. I know exactly what happened."
"Oh, yeah?"
"Yeah, we need to talk."
The kid had booked an interview room in another part of the courthouse. It was just Brad and him. The kid shut the door, flipped open his laptop, and waved Brad into a chair. He turned the laptop so Brad could see it.
"Someone accessed your phone records."
"How do you know?"
"We have contacts with the carrier."
"And?"
"They accessed your cell phone records when you were off work."
"Why?"
"As you probably know, Your phone contains GPS technology. That means your location is recorded whenever you make a call. He tapped a key. Graphing your locations over a 30-day period, we find this. The map showed red dots all over town, but a cluster of dots in one part of Westview. The kids zoomed in. That's the soccer field.
You mean they knew I went there?
Yeah, Tuesdays and Thursdays. Somebody knew that 2 weeks ago.
So this was a setup,
Brad said. That's what I've been telling you, yes.
What about the girl?
We're working on her. She's no ordinary teenager. We think she's a Philippine national. She's appeared on a webcam masturbating for money. Anyway, what's relevant now are the inconsistencies in her story. If you look at the hotel security camera, he tapped another key. You see here that she turns her body away from the camera while waiting for the elevator, opens her purse, and touches her face. We think she's putting drops or some irritant in her eyes. When she gets in the elevator a moment later, she is visibly crying. But notice, as a supposed rape victim crying in the elevator, apparently very upset, she doesn't go right to the hotel desk to report that she has been raped. You have to wonder why not.
Uh-huh, Brad said, eyes narrowing.
Instead, she goes straight through the lobby to her car. Security camera in the parking lot shows her driving away at 5:17 p.m. Depending on traffic, the drive from the hotel to the hospital is between 11 and 17 minutes. She doesn't show up until 6:05 p.m., 45 minutes later. What was she doing during that time?
Injuring herself?
No. We've had several experts look at the pictures from the hospital, and the nurse who examined her was an experienced trauma nurse. The pictures are very clear. We think she met an accomplice who produced the injuries for her.
You mean some guy?
Yes.
Then he would have left his DNA, right?
He wore a condom.
So at least two people were involved in this.
Actually, we think a whole team was involved, the kid said. You were very professionally set up. Who would do this to you? Brad had been thinking about that while he sat in his jail cell, and he knew there was only one answer.
Rick, the boss. He's wanted me out of there ever since I started.
And you were trying to boff his girl?
Hey, I wasn't trying. I was doing it.
And now you're suspended from your job. You've got 9 months minimum before you go to trial, and you're looking at 10 to 20 if you lose in court. Nice. The kid flipped his laptop shut and stood.
So what happens now?
We'll work on the girl. If we can get a prior history, maybe some video of her on the internet, we can press the DA to drop the charges. But if this thing goes to trial, it's not good.
Fucking Rick!
Yeah,
you owe him, buddy.
He headed for the door. Just do yourself a favor, okay? Stay away from that soccer field.
From Science Magazine's News of the Week. Neanderthal man, too cautious to survive? Scientist finds a species death gene. An anthropologist has extracted a gene from Neanderthal skeletons that he says explains the disappearance of this subspecies. People don't realize that Neanderthals actually had larger brains than the modern Cro-Magnon men. They were stronger and tougher than Cro-Magnons, and they made excellent tools. They survived several ice ages before the Cro-Magnons came on the scene. Why, then, did Neanderthals die out? The answer, according to Professor Sheldon Harmon of the University of Wisconsin, was that the Neanderthals carried a gene that led them to resist change. Neanderthals were the first environmentalists. They created a lifestyle in harmony with nature. They limited game hunting and they controlled tool use. But this same ethos also made them intensely conservative and resistant to change. They disapproved of the newcomer Cro-Magnons, who painted caves, made elaborately decorated tools, and who drove whole herds of animals over cliffs, causing species extinction.
Today we consider the cave paintings a wondrous development, but the Neanderthals regarded them as so much graffiti. They saw it as prehistoric tagging, and they viewed the elaborate Cro-Magnon tools as wasteful and destructive of the environment. They disapproved of these innovations, and they stuck to the old ways. Eventually, they died out as a species. However, Harmon insists that the Neanderthals bred with the modern Cro-Magnons. They unquestionably did, because we have identified this same gene in modern human beings. This gene is clearly a Neanderthal remnant, and it promotes cautious or reactionary behavior. Many of the people who today wish to return to the glorious past, or at the very least to keep things as they are driven by this same Neanderthal gene. Harmon described the gene as modifying dopamine receptors in the lateral posterior cingulate gyrus and in the right frontal lobe. There's no question about its mode of action, he said. Harmon's claim has provoked a firestorm of criticism from academic colleagues. Not since E.O. Wilson published his sociobiology thesis 2 decades ago has such furious controversy erupted. According to Columbia University geneticist Vartan Gorvald, Harmon was injecting politics into what should be a purely scientific inquiry. Not at all, Harmon said. The gene is present in both Neanderthals and modern humans. Its action has been confirmed in scans of brain activity. The correlation between this gene and reactionary behavior is indisputable. It's not a matter of politics, of left or right. It's a question of basic attitude, whether you are open to the future or fearful of it, whether you see the world as emergent or deteriorating. We have long known that some people favor innovation and look positively toward the future, while others are frightened of change and want to halt innovation. The dividing line is genetic and represents the presence or absence of the Neanderthal gene. The story was picked up in the New York Times the next day. Neanderthal gene proves environmental agenda. Fears of rampant technology justified. Stuttgart, Germany. Anthropologist Sheldon Harmon's discovery of a Neanderthal gene which promotes environmental preservation proves the need for sound environmental policy, said Greenpeace spokesperson Marsha Madsden. The fact that Neanderthals lost the battle for the environment should serve as a warning to us all. Like the Neanderthals, we will not survive unless we take radical global action now. And in the Wall Street Journal, caution killed the Neanderthals. Is the precautionary principle lethal? Oppose free markets at your peril, Club for Growth notes, by Steve Weinberg. An American anthropologist has concluded that Neanderthals died from a genetic predisposition to resist change. In other words, Neanderthals applied the precautionary principle so dear to illiberal, reactionary environmentalists. That was the view of Jack Smythe of the American Competitive Institute, a progressive Washington think tank. Smythe said, "The extinction of Neanderthals serves as a warning to those who would halt progress and take us back to a life that is nasty, brutish, and short." In the corner of the office, the TV showed Sheldon Harmon, professor of anthropology and self-proclaimed discoverer of the Neanderthal gene, being assaulted during a lecture with a bucket of water poured over his head. On screen, the event was shown repeatedly in slow motion, the water sloshing over a skinny, bald guy who looked oddly amused. "See, he's smiling," Rick Deal said. "This is all a publicity stunt to promote the gene." "Probably," Josh Winkler said. "They had cameras there to catch it." "Exactly," Deal said. "And aside from the publicity this guy is getting for his damn Neanderthal gene, he is claiming a mode of action closely related to our maturity gene. Activation of the cingulate gyrus and so on could steal our thunder." "I doubt it," Josh said. "Dozens of genes work in the cingulate gyrus." "Even so," Rick said, I think we ought to announce. Soon. I want to get the maturity gene out there. Josh said, With all due respect, Rick, we'd be premature.
You've tested the gene in rats. That's gone well.
Yes, but it's not exactly newsworthy. Showing baby rats pushing turds in a cage, that won't make the evening news.
Deal nodded slowly. Yeah, true. We need something better.
Josh said, What's the urgency?
The board. Ever since Brad got arrested, his uncle has been pissed. Seems to think Brad's problems are our fault. Anyway, he's pressing us to put the company on the map with a big announcement.
Fine, but we're not there yet.
I know. But what if we just...
What if we just say that we're ready to start human testing?
Josh shivered.
I wouldn't, he said. I mean, we haven't even applied to the FDA for...
I know, stage one. So let's make the application.
Rick, you know what a stage one application requires. It's a stack of research data and forms 10 feet high. That's just to start the process. And we would have to lay out a timetable of milestones.
Rick waved his hand impatiently.
I know. I'm saying we just announce it. You mean announce it when we're not doing it?
No. Announce that we're going to do it.
But that's my point, Josh said. It'd be months before we could even file.
Reporters don't care. We just say that Biogen Research in Westview Village is ready to begin stage one testing and is in the process of making an application to the FDA.
For the maturity gene?
Yes. To be inserted with a retrovirus vector.
And what will we say the maturity gene does?
Josh said, I don't know. We could say that it cures drug addiction.
Josh felt a chill. Why would we say something like that?
Well, it makes sense, don't you think? Rick Deal said. The maturity gene promotes balanced, mature behavior, which is, by definition, addiction-free behavior.
I guess.
You guess? Deal turned to face him. Let's show a little enthusiasm here, Josh. I'm telling you, this is a great idea. What's the recidivism rate in addiction treatment programs today? 80%? 90%? 100%? Most rehab doesn't work for most people, that's a fact. How many addicts are there in this country? Christ, we got more than 1 million in prisons. So how many are on the streets? 20 million? 30 million?
Josh was beginning to sweat. That would be like 8 or 10% of the population.
Sounds about right. I'd bet 10% of the American population is addicted to drugs. When you include alcohol, 10% easy. Which makes the maturity gene a hell of a product.
Josh was silent.
What do you have to say, Josh?
I guess it's a good idea.
You wouldn't be fucking with me, would you?
No, Josh said. Of course not.
You wouldn't be holding out on me. Striking out on your own?
No, he said. Why would you say that?
Your mother called today, Deal said.
Oh, shit.
She's very proud of what you've done and doesn't understand why I haven't given you a promotion.
Josh sank into a chair. He felt drenched in cold sweat. So, what are you going to do? He said.
Rick Deal smiled. Give you a promotion, of course, he said. Did you keep records of the dosages you administered?
In a glass-walled conference room on Madison Avenue, the marketing firm of Watson & Name was engaged in naming a new product. The room was packed with hip young people in their teens and twenties, all casually dressed as if they were attending a rock concert, instead of a dry lecture from a professor standing in a lectern, wearing a bow tie and talking about a gene called A587996B. The professor was now showing graphs of enzymatic action, black squiggly lines on white. The kids sagged, slumped in their seats,
thumbed their blackberries. Only a few tried to focus on the material. Sitting in the back of the room, the team leader, a psychologist named Paul Goad, spun his finger in the air, signaling the professor to wind it up. Bowtie looked surprised, but he concluded smoothly.
"In summary," the professor said, "our team at Columbia University has isolated a gene that promotes social harmony and group cohesion. It does this by activating the prefrontal cortex of the brain, an area known to be important in determining belief and credence. We have demonstrated this gene action by exposing experimental subjects to both conventional and controversial ideas. Controversial ideas produce a distinctive prefrontal signature, whereas conventional ideas create a diffused activation, what you might call a warm glow. Thus, subjects with the gene show a marked preference for conventional thinking and familiar ideas. They also show a preference for group thinking of all kinds. They like television. They like Wikipedia. They like cocktail parties. They like small talk. They like to be in agreement with people around them. Our gene is an important force for social stability and civilization. Since it's the gene that promotes conventional wisdom, we call it the conventional gene."
The audience sat silent, stunned. Finally, one of them said, "You call it what?"
"The conventional gene."
"Jesus, that's terrible. Suicide. Forget it."
"Or," the professor said quickly, "we call it the civilizing gene."
Groans in the room.
"The civilizing gene. That's worse. Worse. Horrible. Ugh. Jump off a bridge."
The professor looked nonplussed.
"What's wrong with that name? Civilization is a good thing, isn't it?"
"Of course," said the team leader, coming forward from the back. Paul Goad stepped up to the lectern.
"The only trouble is, nobody in this country wants to think of themselves as joiners or civilizers. Just the opposite. We're all rugged individualists. We're all rebels. We're anti-establishment. We stand out. We strike out. We do our own thing, go our own way. The herd of independent minds, somebody called it. Nobody wants to feel they're not a rebel. Nobody wants to admit that they just want to fit in."
"But in truth, everybody does want to fit in," the professor said. "At least almost everybody. About 92% of people have the conventional wisdom gene. The real rebels lack it, and they are..."
"Stop right there," the team leader said, holding up his hand. "Just stop. You want to make your gene valuable. That means your gene creates something people want to possess. Something exciting and desirable. Conventional wisdom is not exciting or desirable. It's mundane. It's buttered toast with grape jelly. That's what the group is telling you." He gestured to a chair. "You might want to take a seat, Professor." Goad turned to the group, which now looked slightly more alert. "All right, people, blackberries away. Let's hear it."
"How about the smart gene?"
someone said. "Good, but inaccurate."
"Simplicity gene?"
"Good direction."
"Social gene?"
"Oversell."
"Socializing gene?"
"Therapeutic."
"Wisdom gene? Wise gene?"
"Wise gene. Good. Very good.
Right-thinking gene?"
"Too Maoist or Buddhist. Come on, wake up here.
Party gene. Fun gene. Stonewash genes. Hip-hugger genes. Happy gene. Live it up gene."
Goad was frowning and held up his hand again. "Redirect," he said. "Back up. Rewind. Rethink."
"What's our problem?" "This gene is really the gene for conventional wisdom, the conventional wisdom gene. But we don't want to say that. So, what's good about conventional wisdom? What does embracing conventional wisdom do for a person? Quickly now."
"Makes you belong?"
"You don't stand out.
You think like everybody else. Reduces friction. You fit in. Means you read the Times. Nobody looks at you funny.
Makes your life simpler.
No arguments. Feel safe expressing an opinion. Everybody agrees with you. You're a good person. You feel good. Makes you comfortable.
Goad snapped his fingers and pointed.
Good.
Conventional thinking makes us comfortable.
Yes.
No surprises. No distress. In the world out there, everything is constantly changing every minute. It's not a comfortable place. And everybody wants to feel comfortable, right? Old pair of shoes, comfortable sweats, favorite chair.
Comfortable gene?
Comfort gene. The comfort gene.
Warm and fuzzy gene. Warm gene. Happy gene. Friendly gene. Easy gene. Soothing gene. Smooth gene. Calm gene. Balm gene.
This went on for a while, until finally there were 9 candidates scrawled on the whiteboard. A furious argument ensued as names were deleted, though of course all the names would be concept-tested with focus groups. In the end, everybody agreed the winner would be the comfort gene. "Let's test it in the field," Goad said. "Professor, tell us, where is this gene going commercially?" It was too early to say, the professor explained. They had isolated the gene, but they didn't yet know the full range of diseases associated with it. However, since nearly everybody in the world carried the comfort gene, they believe that many people probably suffered from genetic anomalies involving the gene. For example, people who were overly desirous of joining the majority, that might prove to be a genetic disorder. And people who felt depressed when they were alone, by themselves, conceivably another disorder. People who joined protest marches, went to sports games, who sought out situations where they would be surrounded by lots of like-minded people, a potential genetic disorder. Then there were people who felt obliged to agree with whomever they were with, no matter what was said, yet another disorder. And what about people who were afraid to think for themselves? Fear of independence from the surrounding group.
"Let's face it, that's a lot of people," the professor said. "Nobody thinks for themselves if they can help it."
"You mean all this behavior is going to be considered pathological?" someone asked.
"Any compulsive behavior is pathological," the professor answered.
"But positive behavior? Protest marches?"
"Our position," the professor said, "is that we are on the verge of identifying a range of disease states all related to sociability."
These genetic anomalies involving the comfort gene had not yet been definitively established, but Columbia University had applied for a patent on the gene itself, meaning that the gene would have increasing value as disorders involving it were identified with certainty. Goad coughed. "We've made a mistake. These are all disorders of sociability. This needs to be the sociability gene." And so it was. From Business Online,
"Scientists find gene for sociability. Is the tendency to sociability inherited? Scientists at the Morecambe Laboratories at Columbia University believe that it is. They report they have found the gene that regulates it, and they have applied for a patent on the gene."
Op-ed commentary from the New York Times.
"A sociability gene. When will this nonsense stop? Columbia University researchers now claim to have found a sociability gene. What's next? The shyness gene? The reclusive gene? The monastic gene? How about the get-off-my-back gene? In truth, researchers are taking advantage of the public's lack of knowledge about how genes actually operate. No single gene controls any behavioral trait. Unfortunately, the public doesn't know that. They think there's a gene for eye color, for height, and for hair curliness, so why not one for sociability? geneticists will not speak out. They all sit on the boards of private companies and are in a race to identify genes they can patent for their own profit. Will this ever stop? Evidently not.
From Grist Online.
Feeling sociable? That's patented. The research office of Columbia University has applied for a patent on a gene that it says controls sociability. Does this mean that one day everyone on antidepressants or ADD medications or anxiety medications will have to pay a royalty to Columbia? Reportedly, pharmaceutical giants in Switzerland are bidding frantically to license the gene.
Fact-finding hearing of the Bioethics Review Panel at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda was carefully structured to feel collegial and unintimidating. Everyone sat at the same long table in the third-floor conference room of the main building, a familiar setting, with notices for upcoming seminars tacked on the walls and the aging coffee maker sputtering in the corner. The coffee was notoriously awful. Nobody drank it. The six scientists on the review panel dressed a little more formally for this meeting. Most had put on jackets, one even wore a tie, but they sat slouched and relaxed as they talked to the person being investigated, Dr. Ronald Marsh, 41, who sat at the same table with them. And how, exactly, did this 12-year-old girl die? Dr. Marsh was a professor of medicine at the University of Texas in Austin. She suffered from congenital transport factor deficiency. CTFD was a fatal genetic deficiency. This girl was treated with diet and renal dialysis from the age of 9 months. She showed some stunting of growth, but no mental retardation. She and her family both wanted this procedure in the hope that she could have a normal life, not be tied to a machine forever. As you know, it's not much of a life, especially for a young kid. Those around the table listened impassively. In looking to the future, Marsh continued, we all recognize that she could not be maintained through adolescence. Hormonal changes were already affecting her metabolism. She was certain to die in the next 3 to 4 years. It was on that basis that we undertook the procedure to insert the gene into her body. He paused. The risks were known. One of the scientists said, these risks were discussed with the family? Of course, in detail. And with the patient? Yes, she was a bright girl. She was the one who first proposed the procedure. She read about it on the internet. She understood that the risks were enormous. Did you give the family an estimate of those risks? We did. We told them the chances of success were on the order of 3%. And they went ahead anyway. Yes, the daughter pushed them. She felt that if she was going to die anyway, she might as well take the chance. She was a minor. Yes, Marsh said, but she was also the one with the disease. You got signed releases? Yes. We've read those releases. Some of us felt the releases struck an unrealistic, positive tone, minimizing risks. The releases were prepared by the hospital's legal department, Marsh said, and you will notice the family signed off on a statement that they had been fully informed of the risks. What they were told is also noted in the patient's charts. We would not have proceeded without fully informed consent. During that speech, the head of the panel, Dr. Robert Bellarmino, slipped into the room and eased into a seat at the end of the table. So you did the procedure? Dr. Marsh was asked. We did. What vector was used? Modified adenovirus infusion in combination with standard Barlow immunosuppression protocols. And the outcome?
She spiked a fever almost at once. It ran to 107 degrees. She had signs of multiple organ system failure on the second day. Liver and kidney function did not recover. She died on the third day.
There was a short silence.
If I may make a personal comment, Marsh said, this has been a shattering experience for all of us at the hospital, and shattering for me personally. We had cared for this girl since infancy. She was beloved by everyone on the staff. She was a little ray of sunshine whenever she came into the clinic. We attempted this risky procedure because she wanted it. But at night I asked myself, was it the right thing to do? And I always feel I had an obligation to take that risk with the patient if that was what she wanted. She wanted life. How could I deny her that chance?
A cough. But, your team had no experience with gene transplantation.
No. We considered sending her to another team.
Why didn't you?
No one else would do the procedure.
What did that tell you?
Marsh sighed. Have any of you seen a patient die of CTFD? Their kidneys necros. Their livers shut down. Their bodies swell, turn a purple-gray color. They can't breathe. They're in agony. They take days to die. Should I have waited for that to happen to this lovely girl? I didn't think so.
There was another moment of silence at the table. The mood was distinctly disapproving.
Why is the family suing now?
Marsh shook his head. I haven't been able to speak to them.
They have stated in court documents that they weren't informed.
They were, Marsh said. Look, we all hoped it would work. Everybody was optimistic. And parents can't really accept the truth that a 3% success rate means 97% of the patients die. 97%. It's almost certain death. They knew that. And when their hopes were dashed, they felt cheated, but we never misled them.
After Dr. Marsh left the room, the panel met in closed session. Of the 7 members on the panel, 6 were outraged. They argued that Marsh was not telling the truth now and had not told the truth before. They said he was reckless. They said that he gave genetics a bad name, which the field now had to overcome. They spoke of the Wild West of his going off half-cocked. They were clearly moving towards censure of Marsh and recommending that he lose his license and his ability to apply for government grants. The head of the panel, Rob Bellarmino, said nothing for a long time. Finally, he cleared his throat.
I can't help but reflect, he said, that these arguments were exactly the same as those first voiced when Christian Barnard did the first heart transplant.
But this isn't the first of anything.
Going off half-cocked, not seeking proper authorization, liable to lawsuits.
Let me remind you, Bellarmino said, what Bernard's original statistics were. His first 17 patients died almost immediately. He was called a killer and a charlatan. But now, more than 2,000 heart transplants are performed every year in this country. Most live 5 to 15 years. Kidney transplants are routine. Lung and liver transplants that were considered outrageous a few years ago are accepted now. Every new therapy passes through a hazardous, pioneering stage. And we will always rely on courageous individuals, such as Dr. Marsh, to take risks.
But so many rules were broken. What would you do to Dr. Marsh?
Bellarmino said. The man can't sleep at night. You see it in his face. His beloved patient died under his care. What greater punishment will you inflict? And who are you to tell him he did the wrong thing? The ethics rules.
None of us looked into that little girl's eyes.
None of us knew her life, her pain, her hopes.
Marsh did.
He knew her for years. Will we now stand in judgment of him? The room was quiet. In the end, they voted to censure the University of Texas legal staff with no penalty for Dr. Marsh. Bellarmino had turned them around, one of the panel said later. It was classic Rob Bellarmino, talking like a preacher, subtly invoking God, and somehow getting everyone to push the envelope. No matter who got hurt, no matter what happened, Rob can justify anything. He's brilliant at it. But in fact, before the final vote was taken, Bellarmino had left the room because he was late for his next meeting. From the bioethics panel meeting, Bellarmino returned to his lab where he was meeting with one of his postdocs. The kid had come to him from Cornell Medical Center, where he had done remarkable work on the mechanisms that controlled chromatin formation. Normally, the DNA of a cell was found inside the nucleus. Most people imagine DNA in the form of a double helix, the famous twisting staircase discovered by Watson and Crick. But that staircase was only one of three forms that DNA might take within the cell. DNA could also form a single strand, or a more condensed structure called a centromere. The particular form was dependent on the proteins associated with the DNA. This was important because when DNA was compressed, its genes were unavailable to the cell. One way to control genes was to change the chromatin of various sections of DNA. So, for example, when genes were injected into new cells, steps also had to be taken to keep the chromatin in an available form through the use of added chemicals. Bellarmino's new postdoc had done breakthrough research on methylation by certain proteins and their effect on chromatin structure. The kid's paper, Genome Protein Accessibility Control and Adenine Methyltransferase, was a model of clear writing. It was bound to be important and would make the kid's reputation. Bellarmino was sitting in his office with the kid, who was looking eager as Bellarmino scanned the paper. Excellent. Just excellent, he tapped the paper. I think this work does great credit to the lab, and of course to you. Thank you, Rob, the kid said. And you have 7 co-authors in place, and I am appropriately high on the list? Bellarmino said. 3rd, the kid said. But if you felt 2nd position was warranted... Actually, I am remembering a conversation we had a few months back in which we discussed possible methylation mechanisms, and I suggested to you... Yes, I remember the very mechanisms you elucidate here. I feel rather strongly that I should be the lead author. The kid blinked. He swallowed. That ensures the paper will be cited more often, Bellarmino said, which is important for a contribution of this magnitude. And of course the exact listing is just a formality. As 2nd author, you will be understood to have done the footwork here, the fill-in-the-gaps labor. From your standpoint, it's really a win-win. You will get greater citations, and you will see much larger grants coming your way. He smiled. I can assure you of that. Your next work will be entirely independent. And in a year or two, I'll be supporting you for a lab of your own. The kid gulped. I understand. Good, good. Make these changes, shoot it back to me, and I'll submit it to Nature. I think this deserves a better platform than Science, which is a little down at the heels these days. I'll call over to Nature and make sure the editor understands the importance of this paper and see that we get immediate publication. Thanks, Rob, the kid said. Anytime, Rob Bellarmino said.
Wet art on display. Transgenic organisms shown in galleries. Living creatures for sale. In London, South African artist Laura Sinti displayed a transgenic cactus that contained human genetic material and grew human hairs. Sinti said, "The cactus with all its hairs coming out is showing all the desires, all the signs of sexuality. It doesn't want to be trapped. It wants to be released." When asked about the public reaction to the cactus, Sinti said, "Bald men are particularly interested." Artist Marta de Menezes created modified butterflies where one wing was different from the other. She said, "People were very shocked at first. They didn't think it was a good idea." She said that next, she would make the stripes of zebrafish vertical instead of horizontal, so the fish would look more like zebras. These changes would be inherited. Finnish artist Oran Katz grew pig wings in culture from pig bone marrow stem cells. He said the artist's team played music to the pig cells to make them grow. "We downloaded lots of pig songs and played them to the cells." He said the cells seemed to do better with music. Chicago-based artist Eduardo Kack created a transgenic rabbit called Alba that glowed green. The fertilized egg of an albino rabbit was injected with GPF, the gene for green fluorescent protein from a Pacific Northwest jellyfish. The animal that grew from the egg now glows. A furor resulted. Kack observed that the rabbit does make some people uncomfortable, but noted that GPF is a common research tool and has been injected into yeast, molds, plants, fruit flies, mice, and cow embryos. Kack said he was looking forward to making a fluorescent dog. Alba died prematurely of unknown causes. So did the transgenic cactuses.